which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Laura, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 23rd issue of the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. It's bonkers. Jennifer Hegseth's hands-on roles in her husband's Pentagon. After an 18-year career at Fox News, she is now her husband's most influential advisor and de facto producer, shaping the job as no Pentagon spouse has before. By Elizabeth Bumelier. There has never been a Pentagon spouse quite like Jennifer Hegseth. In May, she was in camouflage shorts and a sweat-drenched t-shirt that said, "This is war," working out with sailors, Marines, and her husband, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, on the deck of the USS Boxer in Singapore. In June, she and six of the couple's seven children accompanied Mr. Hegseth to the D-Day commemoration in Normandy, where a Defense Department promotional video with a swelling cinematic soundtrack captured husband and wife walking arm in arm on Omaha Beach. The imagery seemed to cast her as the First Lady of the Pentagon. Last year, Washington got a different view when she was included in a group signal chat in which Mr. Hegseth shared attack plans for U.S. warplanes targeting the Houthis in Yemen. This month, she took on a new role, chair of the President's Military Spouse Commission, an unpaid position aimed at improving the lives of military families. She stood behind President Trump in the Oval Office as he announced the initiative. "This is a big deal today," she told the president. "We're super grateful." Ms. Hegseth was for years Mr. Hegseth's producer at Fox News as he built a broadcast career. Now, 7 years into their marriage, she is his most influential advisor and his de facto producer at the Pentagon. She has prepped him for appearances, sat in on his meetings with journalists, interviewed potential members of his staff, and brainstormed ideas for the Defense Department videos he, and sometimes she, appears in. Last year, she was in a highly sensitive meeting with her husband and top British defense officials after the United States temporarily stopped sharing military intelligence with Ukraine, the Wall Street Journal first reported. In a previously undisclosed part of that meeting, a Trump administration official told the New York Times the British indicated that they had officers on the ground in Ukraine and that without the U.S. intelligence, including early warnings of incoming missiles from Russia, the officers' lives were at risk. The British spoke in general terms, the official said, because the presence of Mrs. Hegseth made them uneasy. Later, they had a smaller meeting without her to go into detail. The chief Pentagon spokesman, Sean Parnell, said on Tuesday that Mrs. Hegseth was only in the meeting for introductions, left soon after, and has not been present for any Defense Department conversation or meeting where classified information was discussed. Mrs. Hegseth has also encouraged Mr. Hegseth's adversarial relationship with the news media, the administration official said. And although she was a journalist for two decades, she has worked with her husband to bar reporters from the building. The New York Times is suing the Defense Department over its restrictions on reporters who cover the Pentagon. Her involvement in the Defense Department is so unusual that it has led to questions about Mr. Hegseth's leadership. He is already under pressure for the high cost of the Iran war, shrinking munitions stockpiles, poor conditions aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln during an 8.5-month deployment in the Middle East, firings of senior military leaders, and blocking the promotions of women and minorities. It's bonkers that the defense secretary would involve his wife in his sensitive official duties, including sharing details of an impending military operation, and face zero consequences, said John Illioit, who left the Pentagon as chief spokesman after 3 months working under Mr. Hegseth and has been critical of his leadership. Any president deserves better judgment from his national security leaders. This is not normal, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, a senior Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said last year on MSNBC during the uproar over Mrs. Hegseth's inclusion in the chat and high-level meetings. Secretary Hegseth has one of the highest levels of classification access. He can't just hand that to his wife and say, "Here, honey, hold my beer and hold my classified information." Mrs. Hegseth declined to be interviewed for this article, which is based on interviews with 20 current and former administration officials and people who know Mrs. Hegseth in other capacities. Most declined to be named for fear of reprisal. In a statement, Mr. Parnell called Mrs. Hegseth an accomplished leader in her own right and a devoted military spouse, who is a vital asset and a true force multiplier for our mission. The Defense Department, he said, not only welcomes her current leadership, but actively plans to involve her even more deeply in the future. The Pentagon has not said if Mrs. Hegseth has a security clearance, although in the past year there have been no reports that she is attending sensitive meetings with foreign leaders. She has still slipped quietly into the Pentagon, including using an elevator from the building's garage that opens directly into Mr. Hegseth's office suite. She is in direct contact with members of her husband's inner circle, among them Ricky Beria, Mr. Hegseth's chief of staff, and Tammy Radabaugh, a close friend of Mrs. Hegseth and a fellow former producer at Fox. Mrs. Radabaugh has become a senior advisor to Mr. Hegseth for communication strategy and is considered Mrs. Hegseth's eyes and ears at the Pentagon. She did not respond to a request for comment. One person familiar with Mr. Hegseth's thinking said that the defense secretary likes his wife to travel with him to keep him out of trouble. Mr. Hegseth, who has a history of heavy drinking, has himself made clear he needs his wife at his side. He often credits his two J's, Jennifer and Jesus, with transforming his life. "My Jenny, my wife, Jennifer, changed my life, saved me. There's just no doubt about it," he told Megyn Kelly on her podcast in December 2024, weeks before his confirmation hearing. "And without those two J's, I wouldn't be sitting here right now." There is one Hegseth family rule. "Oh, it's just obey God," Mrs. Hegseth said. It was a December podcast recording with Katie Miller, a veteran advisor from Mr. Trump's first term and the wife of Stephen Miller, Mr. Trump's most powerful policy aide. Mrs. Hegseth and her husband were seated on a small sofa at the Pentagon, knees touching, with an American flag hanging behind her shoulder. She was in jeans, a black sweater, and high heels. He was in a dress shirt with sleeves rolled up to show his tattoos. Mrs. Hegseth frequently squeezed her husband's arm and interlaced her fingers with his when he put his hand on her knee. At times, they finished each other's sentences. "She homeschools her children," she told Mrs. Miller, in accordance with a conservative Christian curriculum at the family's home in Washington called Quarters 8, a 20-room, white-columned colonial revival house. It was built by the Gilded Age architectural firm McKim, Mead, and White on a channel parallel to the Potomac River on the Fort McNair military base. "I watch her the night before at the whiteboard in our dining room, which is now a converted schoolhouse, and she's erasing Thursday and writing Friday. And here's the tasks we've got for the day," Mr. Hegseth said in an interview. "It's really been a blessing to watch her embrace that role." On many Sundays, she attends services with her family and a security detail at Christ Church, Washington, D.C., located in a meeting space on Capitol Hill, owned by the Conservative Partnership Institute. The church is part of the community of Reformed Evangelical Churches, whose leaders believe the United States should be a Christian nation and that people should vote by casting one vote per household, typically led by a man. If they're in town, they're usually in attendance, said Joe Rigney, a pastor and a leader of the church network who delivered a sermon at the church on a hot July day. Even though the Hegseths were out of the city, there was a large police presence, keeping a handful of protesters away from the building. Publicly, Mrs. Hegseth has embraced the life of a more traditional official Washington spouse. In May, she was the host of a Pentagon garden party in honor of military mothers. In February, she was at Fort Campbell, reading a book to children at the Defense Department school there. Last December, she hosted Gold Star families, relatives of service members killed in war or on active duty, for a Christmas tea at the Pentagon. She told Mr. Trump during the announcement of the spouse commission that her meetings with military families from Fort Campbell to Singapore had made her aware of the problems they face. It's housing, it's health care, it's employment, it's child care, it's education, she said. On weekends, Mrs. Hegseth is often on the couple's 77-acre, $3.4 million farm outside Nashville, where photos on her Instagram feed have captured her children riding horses and Mr. Hegseth holding a dead raccoon that killed four family hens. The Hegseths are not regulars on Washington's party circuit. Her family is her life, Ms. Miller, a good friend of Mrs. Hegseth, said in an interview. So many people in D.C. are transient or looking over the person they're talking to or looking for the next person conversation or only talk with the important spouse. She's one of the rare people who, when we get together, it just feels very normal. Mrs. Hegseth, 49, is a daughter of a Lockheed Martin executive whose work took the family from Maitland, Florida, to Hunt Valley, Maryland, a suburb north of Baltimore. She majored in journalism at Towson University in Towson, Maryland, and in 2001 landed a job as a producer at WPIX in New York. In 2006, she began an 18-year career at Fox as an executive producer on Fox and Friends, the cable network's marquee morning show. Numerous colleagues there described her as a talented workhorse, smart, organized, driven, with the stamina to thrive in the brutal early morning hours of the 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. program. She also had a good eye for selecting what several called the red meat stories that appealed to Fox viewers. In 2010, she married Dennis Rauchet, a New York real estate developer, and had three children with him. Mr. Hegseth, a Princeton graduate and a decorated veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, arrived at Fox as an on-air contributor in 2014. He was soon a rising star, although he had episodes of heavy drinking that company officials or co-workers had to address. An early marriage had ended in 2009, and he married his second wife in 2010. The couple had three children. Mr. Hegseth has said he never had a drinking problem. When Will Kane, a Fox colleague of Mr. Hegseth's, asked him on a 2021 podcast if he drank heavily after serving in Iraq, Mr. Hegseth replied, "Oh yeah." He vowed he wouldn't drink at all as Secretary of Defense. By 2016, when Mr. Hegseth was regularly co-hosting Fox and Friends Weekend, he and Mrs. Hegseth were having an affair. The relationship burst into the open at the Fox and Friends Christmas party that year when Mrs. Hegseth's husband turned up, even though the event was limited to Fox employees. Mr. Hegseth, who had been drinking, was upset to see him and caused a disturbance that the Human Resources Department had to address with him, according to a person with knowledge of the situation. Timothy Parlator, Mr. Hegseth's former personal lawyer and now his special advisor at the Pentagon, has said the Christmas party episode is not true. Fox moved Mrs. Hegseth in January 2017 to be executive producer of Waters World, then on Saturday nights. In June of that year, she and her first husband were divorced. In August, she gave birth to a daughter with Mr. Hegseth, Gwendolyn Hope. In September, Mr. Hegseth's second wife filed for divorce. In October, Mr. Hegseth was accused of raping a woman at a speaking event in California. Charges were never filed, and Mr. Hegseth has said the accusation was false. But he said he paid the woman $50,000 as a part of a settlement to protect his family and his job at Fox News. Mrs. Hegseth has never commented publicly on the matter. After this chain of events, Mr. Hegseth began what he has described as a religious transformation. In 2018, the Hegseths joined Colts Neck Community Church in New Jersey, where they were living at the time. The Evangelical Church is affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention, and Mr. Hegseth, who grew up attending Sunday services at a Baptist church in Minnesota, said Mrs. Hegseth at first showed some reluctance. She was wary of what evangelical Baptists were like, Mr. Hegseth told the magazine Nashville Christian Family. But within 20 minutes, he added, we felt at home. People who worked with Mrs. Hegseth at Fox do not recall her talking openly about faith. Her father's 2009 funeral had been at a Methodist church. But she became a partner on her husband's journey. After the two were married in August 2019 at the Trump National Golf Club in Colts Neck, her Instagram feed became noticeably more religious. Glory to God, she wrote in a June 2022 post when Battle for the American Mind, a book Mr. Hegseth wrote with David Goodwin, a pioneer in conservative Christian education, landed as number one on the New York Times bestseller list. By then, Mrs. Hegseth was vice president of Fox Nation, a Fox subscription streaming service, as well as the executive producer of The Miseducation of America, a documentary show that streamed for 2 seasons on Fox Nation. It starred Mr. Hegseth assailing what he called the liberal takeover of American schools. The Hegseths bought their Tennessee farm in 2022. And in the final 2023 episode of the series, Mr. Hegseth took viewers to his children's school outside Nashville to showcase, he said, the beauty of classical Christian education. In a book of collected writings about motherhood, Mrs. Hegseth wrote that they had moved from New Jersey because the societal landscape had become so scary that we felt that sending them out the door was like sending them into a cultural ambush without any protection. It is unclear how many of the children in their blended family, ranging from 16 to 9, attended the Nashville school or are homeschooled by Mrs. Hegseth. Under the terms of Mr. Hegseth's 2018 divorce settlement, his children from his second marriage primarily live with their mother in Minnesota, although he sees them there and in Washington and on the Tennessee farm. Mrs. Hegseth had never lived or worked in Washington when she arrived with her husband in December 2024, shortly after she left Fox Nation. She immediately shattered what was expected of a political spouse by accompanying Mr. Hegseth to meetings with startled Republican senators ahead of his confirmation hearings. It was unusual, Mr. Hegseth acknowledged to Ms. Miller on her podcast. I remember the first meeting we went to that she came with, and I was like, and then it felt so right and so natural. In those early days, Mrs. Hegseth also interviewed potential staff members for jobs at the Pentagon. Mr. Ilyot, who was in line for Pentagon spokesman, said he remembered getting a call that Mrs. Hegseth would like to see him. He expected it to be a pleasant meet and greet, but when he got to the offices at the Republican National Committee that Mr. Hegseth used for a time during the transition, he said Mrs. Hegseth asked him in a one-on-one interview unexpectedly detailed and hard-edged questions for some 40 minutes, including how he would handle a hostile news media. Once Mr. Hegseth was in office, Mrs. Hegseth was eager to revoke the credentials of Pentagon reporters who she felt had written negative stories about her husband, the administration official, and a former administration official said. After Mr. Hegseth was told he could run into legal problems by singling out individual reporters, Mr. Ulyatt said, "The Pentagon announced in February a new annual media rotation program that removed the New York Times, NBC News, NPR, and Politico from their workspaces in the building and swapped in the New York Post, Breitbart News, One America News, and HuffPost. Since then, officials have moved all reporters to an annex outside the building for what they say are workspace renovations." In the year and a half since, Ms. Miller said in the interview, Mrs. Hegseth, who settled into Washington, "She's got rhythm. She's got a routine," she said. "They've got a good thing going. And always, the job is a partnership." As Mrs. Hegseth told Ms. Miller on her podcast, recalling her response when she learned that Mr. Trump would be offering her husband the position of defense secretary, "We were ready to serve in any capacity." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Toned arms and a tight prenup. A fitness meets marital contract class offers to teach people about stretches, protein balls, and financial planning by Andrew Zucker. It had the look of a typical Hamptons workout class. There were rows of yoga mats, women in ritzy sportswear, and olive oil shots on offer. But it didn't sound like one. "You like a house more in Greenwich than in Scarsdale," Marcy Katz theorized to the group as she perched on a bluestone paved porch in Watermill, New York. "Well, then, all of a sudden, the rules are going to change drastically." Katz is no Tracy Anderson, a fitness instructor to the 1%. Instead, she is a matrimonial lawyer to New York's elite, and on a recent Wednesday morning, she addressed just over 24 women on yoga mats at the 6th installment of Prenups and Pilates, a fitness meets marital contract class. "It's a chance for exercise enthusiasts to pose in downward dog and grapple with the consequences of choosing between Connecticut and Westchester living." The Frankenstein pairing of divorce talk and calisthenics is the brainchild of Lily Donahue, who debuted the concept last year and has also brought it to Casa Cipriani, the members-only Manhattan haunt. Donahue, 35, is the founder of What If Legal, a matrimonial lawyer marketplace of sorts, and the host of a daily podcast aptly named the Prenup Podcast. "My algorithms are all about divorce, prenups, relationships," she said of her social media feed. Donahue, wearing olive green athleisure, kicked off the event by interviewing Katz and a wealth advisor. It took place in the backyard of an East End manse just north of Montauk Highway, and drew many self-employed workers in a mix of relationship statuses, including divorcees and married women. Some attendees donned green and cream hats with the word prenup slapped across them. Blake Rayfield, a 24-year-old influencer, took notes on her iPhone and raised her hand to ask whether prenuptial agreements can be altered during marriages. Katz explained the importance of leverage in establishing these pacts. "I would try to negotiate for whatever you can before the marriage," Katz told Rayfield, who was discussing marriage with her long-term boyfriend. "But you can definitely change it if you're both agreeable." After the legal and financial advice, which lasted 30 minutes, Maria Enright, a 26-year-old Pilates instructor, took control of the event and called for cat-cow stretches. "So just take a deep inhale in through the nose, arching the back. Exhale," she said, as a song by the Nigerian artist Tems blared in the background. Before hosting events like these, Donahue worked at Capital One in business development. It was during her time there that her father was diagnosed with lung cancer. She began having more honest conversations with him about his 6-year divorce from her mother. Their relationship didn't involve a prenup. Donahue discovered that her mother had been evicted from her Park Avenue apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan after the divorce. "I thought that my mom just wanted to move with her boyfriend to New Jersey," she said. "I didn't clock as an 8-year-old that there was no home for us." Those exchanges, in part, spurred Donahue to found her startup almost 2 years ago. Today, she is its only full-time employee. Part of the company's mission is to increase knowledge about prenups. She introduced the fitness concept last December after attending Pilates and Pitches, an event that offered female entrepreneurs free exercise and breakfast in Manhattan. Donahue, similarly, doesn't charge attendees. Instead, the part workout, part educational programming serves as marketing for her company and podcast. She is now planning a prenups and paddle event, using the popular Mexican sport to appeal to men. Donahue's goal is to make dishing about prenups as destigmatized as conversing about egg freezing. "A few years ago, no one wanted to talk about egg freezing," she said. "And now, if you work at a large corporate company and they don't offer you the benefit of egg freezing, they're idiots." Prenups are shedding their taboo. This year, Bells Burden's best-selling book, Strangers, about the collapse of her marriage, included details about her prenup. More than half of engaged or married Americans age 45 and younger have signed one, according to a recent survey. Bloomberg News commissioned from Harris Poll. That was up from 2022, when a Harris Poll found that 41% of Gen Z and 34% of millennials had one. Emily McCarthy, a 43-year-old model agency owner and interior designer, is not one of those people. McCarthy, who lives in West Hampton full-time, didn't sign a prenup before her first marriage. But at the event, she said she hoped to learn more about the option now that she was newly engaged. "Maybe I've now learned the hard way, and maybe I should try to do this correctly," she said. Once the event concluded, the women ventured to a nearby pool house where protein balls and halved pop-up bagels awaited them. Donahue said goodbye to one of the attendees by the porch. "I need to run," she told Donahue. "Wait," Donahue responded. "We need to talk about your prenup." For sale, baby clothes, definitely worn. The perfect pair of Levi's, old Armani. These are the vintage grails some discerning parents are chasing for their toddlers. By Charles W. McFarlane. When Amrit Teets combs through packed flea market fields, she is on the hunt for gems like vintage Levi jeans, hard-to-find band t-shirts, and fringed leather jackets. No, not for herself, for her 3-year-old daughter, whose wardrobe, she estimates, is roughly 70% vintage. "I would rather buy that than a frozen Elsa costume from Amazon," said Teets, 38, who lives in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn and started collecting children's vintage even before she became a mother. "It feels more thoughtful." Parents have long dressed their children in hand-me-downs and secondhand clothes as a matter of practicality. Toddlers seem to outgrow sweaters almost overnight. But lately, the used clothes some parents seek are from rarer provinces and require setting eBay alerts and sifting through pages of Etsy search results. A recent surge in interest for vintage baby clothes has turned what was once a niche corner of the resale market into a gold rush, one observer said, sometimes sending prices of Oshkosh B'gosh overalls and Biddy 1990 tees to eye-watering heights. The trend reflects what is perhaps an eternal parental desire. Parental. For one child to share in one's tastes. For those who favor one-of-a-kind garments with healthy patinas over mass-market fast fashion, that means making sure their children's outfits have the same aura of cool they seek themselves. A big part of why you go for vintage and thrifted pieces is because you want something that you're not just going to see everyone else wearing on the street, said Callie Clarkson, who helped start Cosmo, a secondhand and vintage children's clothing store, with her friend Shanna Cooper. I think it's the exact same for dressing your kids. The shop, which opened on a corner in Bedford Stuyvesant in Brooklyn in June, is mainly a place where customers can sell children's outgrown clothes for store credit or cash, creating a circular fashion ecosystem for local parents. But Cooper, 32, has also begun to plump up the racks with vintage children's wear she sources herself. Cosmo has now joined a constellation of brick-and-mortar stores, including Darling in Brooklyn Heights and Parachute in Greenpoint, that have cropped up over the last few years, selling miniature vintage and secondhand offerings. It's a lot of hunting on eBay for different brands and special things, she said, like a houndstooth dress with a Peter Pan collar by Armani Baby from the early 1990s. Cooper and Clarkson priced it at $30. On a recent afternoon, a pair of Oshkosh Bagosh overalls, $40, a DKNY logo t-shirt, $12, and a onesie with colorfully printed airplanes and parachutists, $22, hung on the racks. Also for sale, a tiny pair of Levi's orange tabs that once belonged to Cooper, displayed on the wall behind the cash app Warp. I think there's definitely a world in which things like this are worth a lot more, Cooper said, holding up the Armani baby dress. But part of it is we want to price things to sell, and we want these to be recirculated. Elsewhere in the expanding world of vintage baby clothes, though, prices can quickly become stratospheric. Recently, Leigh Rabin, who writes the newsletter Recycled Threads, witnessed an eBay auction of a vintage romper featuring Eeyore that sold for over $3,000. Nobody wanted them back 4 years ago, said Rabin, a 37-year-old mother of three in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I couldn't give these things away. The Clifford and Winnie the Pooh overalls, if I had those 4 or 5 years ago, I'd maybe get 10 or 15 bucks for them, she added. She's been buying and selling vintage kids' togs since around 2016, after becoming interested in the classic Oshkosh Bagosh and Gymboree she remembered from her childhood. At the time, she said, few vintage buyers or dealers paid much attention to the small garments. She noticed that the market started to expand around 2020 and 2021 when the COVID-19 pandemic helped spur a broader interest in vintage clothes. Rabin now sells wholesale to other sellers, including some as far-flung as Japan. She also counts celebrities like Halsey and Eric Michael Estrada among her clients. She's happy about the new interest in children's vintage, but I don't necessarily like the price and the competition, Rabin added. Audrey Gelman, the owner of the Six Bells Hotel in the Hudson Valley and founder of The Wing, compared the hype around vintage children's styles on Facebook pages like 90s and Y2K Kids BST, BST stands for Buy, Sell, Trade, to that surrounding Supreme. You have to apply to join them, she said on the Facebook page, which has over 12,000 members. And then sometimes someone will post a drop and everything you want is already bought in about 10 minutes. Gelman has been a member for about a year. Still, she usually enjoys herself as she hunts for brands like Patagonia, health techs for her two toddlers. It's a way to make shopping for your kids' clothes, which can be an annoying task, into something that's fun, she said. There's also a nostalgic appeal. Parents born in the 1990s sometimes dress their kids in the exact clothes they wore at their age. Gelman concedes that building a vintage-heavy wardrobe for her children is mostly for me, but it's a victimless crime. And as many shoppers, place a renewed emphasis on quality and natural fibers. Buying vintage for children also just seems sensible to some parents. Teets, who runs Spread the Jelly, a media company focused on motherhood, said she had noticed that vintage children's clothing really stood the test of time because it's cotton, it's linen, it's cashmere, it's less synthetic. A decades-old baby sweater may have a moth hole or two, but that's fine. There's a sense that these clothes can take it and may even look better with some wear and tear. I like things to feel and look worn, Teets said. I don't mind stains and patching something up. I think it's cooler. At times, though, her daughter has definitely gotten oil on a sweatshirt, she said. And I'm like, damn, that was a good one. But whatever, she's three. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. How a Highbrow Novel Became Celebrity Gossip. Life of M, Rachel Cusk's new book, has a protagonist with an uncanny resemblance to Natalie Portman. But in an interview, Cusk said she never expected it would cause such a frenzy. By Alexandra Alter. Rachel Cusk is in a sunlit bedroom of her home on the west coast of France, talking about her new novel. She wasn't planning on having this conversation about the novel, Life of M, but other people have had a lot to say about whether M is actually Natalie Portman, and whether by writing about an actor who so closely resembles a real celebrity, Cusk has committed some kind of artistic betrayal. Now Cusk has logged on to a video call to explain, even though she'd rather not be explaining. Cusk seems bewildered and a little bit distressed to find herself caught in the harsh spotlight of fame and the kind of tabloid feeding frenzy she evokes in the novel, which features an author who writes about a famous actress. It's very stressful, the thought of these things happening, she said of the swirl of gossip surrounding the book. It's taking the novel that I've created into almost a sort of courtroom or a factual fight, she added. What I've done belongs much more in a world in which fame and these people who are so known and yet so unknown is a part of contemporary consciousness, she said. And if my job is not to go into unexplored areas of contemporary consciousness, then I don't know what it is. Life of M, which raises uncomfortable questions about the nature of fame and our celebrity-obsessed, image-driven culture, has been fodder for discussion and speculation for weeks as it approaches its August 25th release. When advance copies began circulating this summer, the protagonist's similarity to Portman set off a cascade of rumors about whether Cusk had enacted what some called a literary assassination of Portman, depicting her as an empty vessel who lacks an identity beyond her film roles, and the public's perception of her. Cusk, the author of a dozen novels, including the acclaimed Outline trilogy, is known for writing experimental books that blur the boundaries between fiction and real life. Life of M takes this project into tricky new territory. Is Life of M autofiction? A perverse form of fan fiction? Or is it simply the latest experiment from Cusk, one of our most provocative, slippery, and polarizing writers? In conversation, Cusk, 59, came across as warm and frank, even when artfully and politely evading questions. She speaks the way she writes, with exacting precision, sometimes veering into abstract philosophical reflections as if she were working out the puzzle of existence mid-sentence. Over email and in a video call, Cusk, who had initially declined an interview request through her publisher but then decided to talk, seemed determined to maintain a patina of mystery around Life of M. Cusk wouldn't comment on whether she has had any conversations about the novel with Portman, whom she has met. She also wouldn't discuss the speculation that Portman dislikes the book, as M does in the story. She insisted that whether M is based on a real celebrity is not really the point. It's a work of fiction, And I guess explaining how something is created, because it's always created out of a total mishmash of real things and invented schemes and personal material. Once you start to pull on that thread, it would unravel the whole thing, she said. The book explains itself and defends itself pretty comprehensively, she continued. And it's something I created, so to start to explain it kind of ruins it for me. From the very beginning of Life of M, readers are on shaky ground. Its narrator is a nameless author who plans to write a closely observed portrait of a celebrity, identified as M. At first, M is on board, but when she reads the work, she tells the writer she's unhappy with how she is portrayed. The writer is baffled and tells M, "The character was invented by me." Whether or not M resembles Portman is hardly a question. The parallels are specific and numerous. Like Portman, M got her start as a child actor and later starred in a movie about a ballerina who has a mental breakdown and in a film about a celebrity who survived a school shooting. M, like Portman, is the face of a major brand and appears in ads festooned with flowers. Though the city where M lives is not named, it is recognizably Paris, where Portman and Cusk both live. Cusk and Portman have crossed paths, and Portman has called Cusk one of my favorite writers. The pair had a friendly and thoughtful conversation in 2022 about Cusk's novel Second Place, which Portman selected for her book club. Portman's admiration for Cusk's work fed into the feverish debate over Life of M, prompting an avalanche of social media commentary and articles citing unnamed sources close to Portman who claimed she was displeased with the project. There were breathless headlines like, "Is Rachel Cusk's new novel a ruthless betrayal of Natalie Portman?" Portman's representatives declined to comment for this article. Cusk seemed surprised that anyone found the subject of the novel scandalous. As she sees it, famous people enter the public imagination, and though I dislike that phrase, it is part of fame's deal and part of its tragedy. Plenty of movies and novels have featured public figures, she noted, often without stirring much controversy. In some ways, writing a fictional account of a celebrity's glamorous but hollow life is a surprising move for a writer as cerebral and iconoclastic, as Cusk. I don't think anyone could see me as a writer naturally drawn to celebrity culture, she conceded. Yet, from another angle, fame and its trappings seem like perfect territory for Cusk, who has long been preoccupied with the unstable nature of identity. When she had the idea for Life of M, a little more than 2 years ago, Cusk realized that writing about an actor would allow her to explore the themes of selfhood, artifice, and authenticity in a new way. "I couldn't believe I'd never had the idea before," she said. Imagining her way into the life of a famous person also felt like a kind of escape. "Perhaps the book was my arrival at the psychological need, a desire to almost pause being myself and to have some vacation from myself, some other place to go," she said. "It was like, what would it be like to be able to lose yourself or leave yourself? And is that what the celebrity offers?" Using a famous person as a fictional character was, Cusk said, a kind of game. And the rules of the game are that the actor and the narrator are both real. For Cusk, drawing on details from the life of an actor was a way to anchor the story in the real world and then, in a sort of narrative rug pull, reveal the layers of artifice that shape our impressions of reality. When the narrator insists that the vivid account of M's life was all imagined, it's a way of making everything just disappear in a puff of smoke, Cusk said. If readers are unsure what's real and what's made up, that's partly the point. It's almost like the book that you've just read completely explodes and self-destructs at the end, Cusk said. I felt that would possibly make a reader reflect on what they've just read in a rather disorienting way. Born in Canada in 1967 to British parents, Cusk grew up in Los Angeles and in Britain, where she had a miserable time at a Catholic boarding school and later attended Oxford. She published her first novel, Saving Agnes, in 1993, and went on to write 11 more novels and 3 memoirs, which include her account of the trials and sacrifices of motherhood and a brutally honest dispatch from the front lines of her divorce. Her memoirs were slammed by some book critics, especially in England, where she was pilloried as a bad mother to her 2 daughters and a narcissist who callously mined the lives of those around her for material. After the maelstrom unleashed by her divorce memoir, Aftermath, Cusk said she had felt paralyzed and unable to write. She became disillusioned with herself as a subject and resolved to find a new way of writing that sidestepped the problem of subjectivity and authorial identity. Cusk, who isn't on social media, has largely kept her distance from the chatter around Life of M. She hopes the questions and critiques will fall away once people read the novel and realize how weird and subversive it is. To me, the book is a daring book. It's a strange book, and it isn't a scandal or a subject for gossip. It's a strange voyage through territories that are pretty legitimate, that are about the public and the private, she said. I'd like to be allowed to be the strange convection that it is, she said. I don't think it's looking for trouble. Please love my son as I do. The surprising ways I try to navigate my relationship with my ex-husband's new wife. By Denise Ryan. My son Alexander was 12 when his father remarried. I learned he was going to be best man the night before the wedding. He had to write a speech, a homework assignment left to the last minute. Since his father, Chris, got serious with Angela, I knew less and less about Alexander's life with them. You didn't tell me about being best man, I said. I told you months ago, he replied. This is typical for us. Alexander seems to believe I know everything that's going on in his life, and if his thoughts and feelings pass automatically from being his to mine. What goes into a best man speech? He asked. Google it, I said. He worked on the speech while I rolled a lint brush over his rented wedding suit. I had offered to rent the suit as a sort of wedding gift. It would take a line item out of their budget and ensure he looked presentable. Maybe it was my way of saying to Angela, please love my son as I do. What time is the wedding? I asked. I'm getting picked up at 10 a.m., he said. 10 a.m.? Who gets married at 10 a.m.? Dad and Angela, he said. But you knew that. I didn't know that. You never told me. After our divorce and before he met Angela, Chris and I talked on the phone daily. Those calls ended when Angela appeared. Chris and I never talked about how we would never talk anymore. We just stopped talking. I guessed it was a boundary she had imposed and he had embraced, nudging me away as they drew closer. I missed the calls. Although they were mostly about co-parenting, they were a balm for the loss of our marriage. He knew and understood me, and we both knew that no one would ever be as interested in our son as we were. Something funny he said, a forgotten homework assignment, a wedding speech. When Chris and I met on a gray, windswept street corner outside the courthouse to pick up our final divorce and custody paperwork, we understood that things had changed. We would never again weep over our credit card debt, mostly mine. We would learn to call each other by our first names, not sweetie or bun. That day we agreed to always keep our son's best interest at the center of our relationship. We would do divorce differently than our parents had. As we fumbled through early post-divorce relationships, our phone calls were a friendly habit. His first girlfriend, Natalie, was a hairstylist from France, whose social media handle was Oulala. My son did not like her coq au vin, but I did. Chris tolerated my new boyfriend, although he found him bellicose and a little too well-dressed. Chris and I blended Christmas Eves and after-school activities, cared for each other's cats and dogs, and shared snack duty at soccer and baseball. "I don't like it," Janet, my former mother-in-law, said one day when Chris and I were stretched out together on a blanket watching our son at Little League. "You don't like what?" I asked. "I don't like this," she said, blowing her cigarette smoke into the center of our magic circle. "It's uncomfortable." She was visiting from Minneapolis, and for reasons mystifying to me, found it stressful to be around Chris and me together. In her view, divorced people should simply never speak to each other again. How could I explain to her or anyone that I didn't miss being married, but I missed our little family? I missed my mother-in-law's irascible, gravelly voice. I missed how she interacted with my son. I missed the crazy way she started sneezing when she drank too much. I even missed all that smoking. I had divorced my husband. I hadn't divorced the father of my child or his mother. Yet here we were, on the eve of his marriage to someone else, and things had changed. Phone calls between Chris and me had become strictly practical. When, where, and how much? Sure, we had been divorced for 6 years, but I never expected it would all just end. "I have to write something about what Angela can expect once she's married to Dad," my son said. "I could tell you a thing or two," I replied. "I have to write it myself," he said. "Fair enough." "What is something about Dad that you know for certain?" I asked. "He hates it when my socks don't match," I laughed. He started to type. I read the speech before I tucked it into the pocket of his suit. "I love my dad very much and am happy he found such a great lady," he wrote. "Angela, from the very first time we met, when we all went bowling, I liked you right away. You're really nice and fun, and even Buster likes you." For anyone that doesn't know Buster, he's the evil cat. "You're a perfect addition to the family, and not just because you can help me with my math homework, but for your great sense of humor and the fact that you're always happy." Good at math? Great sense of humor? Always happy? How would I know? I wasn't even invited to the wedding. When my son came back from the wedding the next evening, he refused to take the suit off. "Best day of my life," he said. "I didn't want it to end." Alexander's sock joke killed. He got to DJ with his older cousin. Angela looked beautiful. "Well, she's 19 years younger than Dad," I said sourly. He flopped on the bed in his suit, a changed person. We fell into a new routine, with Alexander spending more than just weekends with them. Soon enough, Angela and Chris had a baby, Jack. I dropped Alexander off at the maternity hospital door and secretly wondered if things would change now that Angela had a son of her own. I didn't have to worry. When we were shopping for his back-to-school items that year, Alexander crossed lock off his school supply list. "You need a lock for your locker," I said. "I don't," he said. "Angela gave me hers. It was her lock from high school. She's been saving it for her kids." "What about Jack?" I asked, although he was still in diapers. Alexander shrugged. "She wanted to give it to me." A few days after their second child, Charles, was born, my phone lit up. It was Chris, presumably to ask me to drive Alexander to see the baby. "Should I bring Alexander after soccer?" I asked. "No." His voice was flat. The baby had contracted respiratory syncytial virus and was admitted to the pediatric ICU. He was critically ill with bronchial complications and in the highest risk group for mortality. Because it was viral, there was no treatment other than oxygen and hydration. The doctors had advised Chris and Angela to hope for the best and to prepare for the worst. Chris was exhausted. He hadn't slept in 36 hours. He had to take care of Jack. He had to feed Buster, the evil cat. Angela was at the hospital alone. "Is there anything I can do?" I asked. He paused. She could probably use a vanilla latte. Would she even want me there? I didn't know. I did know that Angela shouldn't be at the hospital by herself, even for an hour. I stocked up on magazines and chocolate bars, picked up 2 vanilla lattes, and gingerly poked my head in the room. The baby had an oxygen mask that covered his head like a space helmet. Wires, electrodes, and tubes connected his tiny body to machines. How's he doing? We don't know, Angela said. They won't tell us anything. I brought Vogue and Vanity Fair, I said, and vanilla latte. Somehow, we got through the next few hours. We joked about the space helmet, asked the medical team questions they still couldn't answer, and leafed through the magazines in silence. I stayed until dark and left when Chris came back. She thanked me for coming. I thanked her for the lock. There was no roadmap for us once Chris married Angela. I didn't know what my role was in our changed family, or even if I had one. But in those anxious hours when my son's newborn brother was fighting for his life, I found my place. I wasn't this baby's mother, and Angela wasn't my son's mother. But through our children, we found a way to love each other. A few days later, my son reported the baby was recovering. When will he be released? I asked. He's home, he said. I already told you that. He hadn't, but it didn't matter. Something had passed through him to me, as love does wordlessly. We were all family. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 23rd issue of the New York Times Style section. Your reader has been Laura. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 6 of World Appears by Michael Pollan. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, broadcasting daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio Reading's broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga between William and Clinton Streets. Radio Reading's website is nfradioreading.org. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555.
The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service now